Welcome back. So far, we've covered only the first half of the 19th century, but by 1852, the land around the old New Fairfield farm was finally preparing to change its name to Eganville. Given that this little village had come up with an appropriate new name for itself, that year it was awarded its very own British colonial post office. Indeed, by 1852, Eganville's official village population had swollen to a happy 175 souls, and John Egan had the village properly surveyed and broken up into neat little parcels that he could sell off as building lots. By 1867, at the time of the Canadian Federation, Eganville had more than doubled its population to 400 living in the village, with hundreds more living and working nearby. The post office was run by Thomas and then John Queeley, and Eganville's Crown Land Office was first operated by T.P. French and then William Harris. Thomas and Michael Hickey had opened a law office by then. While Dr. James P. Lynn set up a medical and dental practice, it was later augmented by Dr. John Shannonhouse and Dr. John Judge, both setting up their medical practices just down the street. By Confederation, Eganville also had four men of the cloth, each attending to the local Anglican, Presbyterian, Roman Catholic, and Wesleyan Methodist congregations. And Eganville had more lumber dealers than it probably knew what to do with. That gaggle included James Bonfield and Robert Turner, who led the pact. Eganville also had two carding mills, one operated by John Childerhouse and the other by Duncan McGregor. It had two blacksmiths, Patrick Brennan, and by the late 1850s, Patrick McHugh. It had two grist mills and four general stores run by Henry George, W.W. Austin, James Reeves, and Daniel Lacey. The village had its own grocery store run by Mrs. Searson and four hotels, and if that wasn't enough, a boarding house run by Thomas Sibury. Besides all that, there was a wide variety of small businesses making a go of it in Eganville. Bonnet and dressmakers, bookkeepers, boot and shoemakers, carpenters, coopers, jewelers, livery and stable keepers, masons, notary publics, saddle and harness makers, tailors, tanners, tinsmiths, upholsters, wagoners, and one rather curious unnamed business listed in 1867 directory as run by a happy-go-lucky fellow, Ozias Banning. We presume his was a place of ill repute, but where a thirsty fellow could wet his whistle. Indeed, by Confederation, Eganville was well on its way to becoming a marketing and supply center for thousands of local farmers and lumbermen alike. As far back as 1844, John Egan annually sent 2.5 million feet of square timber rafts down to Quebec City. Curiously, less than one-fifth of that was cut on Crown land. Most of Mr. Egan's timbers was supplied by small Ottawa Valley subcontractors, jobbers, farmers, and many local Bonnechere Valley settlers in payment for land Egan had sold to them. In 1845, John Egan also helped launch a line of Ottawa River steamboats that traveled between Elmer and Fitzroy Harbor. He later developed a forwarding service that reached as far up the Ottawa as Portage du Fort and eventually Pembroke and beyond. In fact, by 1854, John Egan employed 3,500 shantymen in 100 lumber camps spread over 2,000 square miles of the upper Ottawa Valley. He paid on average $14 to $16 per month, including free shanty room and board. Egan's lumber business consumed on average 6,000 barrels of pork, 10,000 barrels of flour every month, and enough hay and oats to feed 1,600 workhorses and oxen. It's little wonder that Canadian Merchants magazine of the day considered John Egan the first Ottawa Valley lumber king who gave a systematic business character to the lumber trade of the Ottawa. That magazine went on to call Egan the Napoleon of the Ottawa. As early as the 1830s, John Egan had enlisted other young entrepreneurs to come to Eganville, men such as Michael Hickey, an Irish immigrant who became Egan's right-hand man and primary clerk before setting up Eganville's first law practice with his brother Tom. Indeed, during and after the Irish famine, John Egan became a strong supporter of the Irish immigration, placing such advertisements as this one in a September 13, 1851 edition of the Bytown Packet. Steerage passage from Ireland to Quebec. Parties desiring steerage passage for their friends from the ports of Cork, New Ross, or Donegal can do so on applying to John Egan and Company Almer. Who really was this Napoleon of Ottawa? John Egan had been born on November 11, 1811, near Aughrim in County Galway, Ireland. He had immigrated to British North America in 1830 and began clerking at a lumber depot on the Ottawa River, where he learnt the fine art and true science of purchasing lumber shanty supplies and handling lumber trade accounts. Soon, he developed a hankering to strike out on his own and so opened up his first general store in Almer, Quebec. And by March 1836, he had helped fund the Ottawa Lumber Association at Bytown. A year later, he purchased James Wadsworth's thriving property at the Fifth Chute. By August 1839, he married Margaret Gibson of Bytown, and together they had three sons and five daughters. But on July 11, 1857, John Egan died suddenly while on business in Quebec, not yet 46 years of age. 10 years later, given his heavily encumbered estate, Egan's most valuable timber asset was finally sold to J.R. Booth for $45,000. His remaining Eganville businesses were unloaded at fire sale prices, bought mainly by Robert Turner and his partner, James Bonfield, Egan's one-time bookkeeper. But remember, despite naming Eganville after himself, John Egan originally set up shop in Almer, Quebec, and it was Almer that he called home. It was Almer where he raised his family, and it was in Almer where he counted James Wadsworth as one of his closest neighbors and business associates, living as he did just down the street. Indeed, John Egan was mayor of Almer from 1847 to 1855, and it was from Almer in 1848 where he was elected to the Quebec Provincial Parliament of the day. He won that provincial seat again in 1851, and after it became the riding of Pontiac, Egan won it again in 1854, holding it until his death in 1857. In the Almer Church that he helped build and where he had his funeral service, a small tablet still reads, "Sacred to the memory of John Egan, the late MPP for the County of Pontiac, a kind husband, an affectionate father, and a sincere friend. He employed the fruits of his commercial success in acts of noblest generosity. It may be truly said, the poor man never asked his assistance in vain." Of course, considered by his many supporters to be both genial and gentlemanly, John Egan remains no easy character to define. In the summer of 1838, he fought in a duel to defend the honor of a friend. But in 1854, he verbally and viciously attacked, in print, Thomas C. Kiefer, a leading colonial engineer. Many still consider Kiefer a genius, well ahead of his time. Given his development of the Ottawa Valley public works and infrastructure, this was what Kiefer had to say in response to John Egan's anonymous and seeming libel.
In the April 1st, 1804 edition of the Ottawa Citizen, a letter to the editor appeared, signed by Thomas C. Kiefer. It reads, "Sir, in your issue of the 14th last, a correspondent signed himself Progress, and professing a residence in Gatineau, has favored the public with some remarks on the lecture given by Thomas C. Kiefer, Esquire. All that is requisite to make that unique letter complete, and at the same time to have it duly appreciated, is to correct the locus quo from Gatineau to Elmer, and substitute for the signature Progress that of John Egan, MPP. In the exercise of an undoubted right, I discussed the Ottawa navigation policy, which Mr. Egan, like a true Hibernian, makes it a personal matter, declares war against all of my name, and discovers that I am not much of an engineer, and altogether a very mercenary, vindictive, and utterly unscrupulous character. I shall not meddle with Mr. Egan's family, for I have never heard anything about it. Nor will I question his professional ability, for I have every reason to suppose that he is a very good lumberman. But when he comes before the country as a public man, advocating a policy which, if carried out, will involve the expenditures of millions from the provincial treasury, I claim the right of questioning that policy without being shillelaghed out of the field of discussion. Mr. Egan tells the public that my Gatineau works in the shape of slides and booms were failures, the slide at Portage du Fort equally faulty, and that at the Chats it was not calculated for the occurrence of low water. Since he did not hesitate to give a fictitious postmark to his letter to avoid detection, is it not probable that he would include fictions in the document itself? And these fictions are at least as far from the facts as Gatineau is from Elmer, which is 9 miles. I did not build any slides at the Gatineau, nor at Portage du Fort, and I feel it would be a stretch of charity amounting almost to hypocrisy to presume that Mr. Egan was not aware of this when he penned that paragraph. The booms at the Gatineau were not failures in my time, and I have not heard that they have since failed. The Shat slide has been described by the Honorable Malcolm Cameron, Assistant Commissioner of Public Works in 1848, as one of the most perfect works under his department. This slide costs £5,500 sterling, and the tolls received in the 8 years since its construction have exceeded £17,000 sterling. Mr. Egan has made an unfortunate selection of subjects for evil, for I believe the public would be satisfied if all our public works were similar failures to those on the Ottawa. Mr. Egan insinuates that my remarks on shanty and canoe life cast a slur on the settlers of the Ottawa, and to weaken my arguments, which he is careful not to deal with, suggests I am an enemy to the Ottawa. I advocate commencing the Ottawa navigation at St. Anne and Grenville instead of the Shats, and I give preference to railways over a canal above Bytown. This is the extent of my enmity. To prove I entertain no such feelings with respect to Ottawa as are imputed to me, I subjoin an extract from a similar lecture of mine of the previous year, when advocating a railway from Montreal towards the Ottawa. The valley of the Ottawa above Bytown and Perth is a cul-de-sac with no outlet above those two towns. It is well settled and a grand agricultural country for more than 100 miles above Bytown, and the most valuable timber region, perhaps in the world. It abounds in minerals, fertile sod, and water power undammed. The import trade of this region is greater for the population than perhaps any other part of America, because not only must the greater portion of their consumption be imported, but as the lumbering business is conducted on the cash principle and wages are highly remunerative, the population are more able to and do consume more, and have done so better than any country population I am acquainted with. I speak from experience when I say I never saw elsewhere money more plenty and the means of comfort more universally diffused than on the upper Ottawa. The reason? The population, instead of being idle during the winter and consuming their substances like bears in a hollow tree, are steadily employed on cash wages. Mr. Egan asks, who constructed the St. Anne's Canal? A keifer? Who left the approach to said canal with a bar that is a hindrance, etc.? This is another Gatineau. The keifer family had nothing to do with the location nor construction of that work, and one of them opposed the location. Mr. Egan insults the good sense of your readers when he tells them the Ottawa has been neglected, because the Kiefer family strenuously opposed all expenditures in Lower Canada. As an MP, he ought to know that engineers do not make the annual appropriations or order the execution of the works. It is true they may, sometimes, by an honest report, prevent a job where the government has been imposed upon by the schemes of some pertinacious MP. It is not shown how I have been well paid for my opposition, but I will attempt to show how Mr. Egan is to be paid for his support to the Grand Trunk policy. Although I will not assert, as he has done, that he was bought, preferring to assume that in his case, virtue brings its own reward. In fact, if the Shat Canal were a blossom of that policy, my opposition would be vindicated. It certainly is a remarkable instance of that swift recompense which should ever follow true patriotism, that in the very first session after Mr. Egan's labors on the Railway Committee, he received £50,000 sterling for his country, and above all, that the expenditure of the sum should be ordered as to rebound to that gentleman's personal interest, as well as to his political glory, especially when there are several circumstances which seem to favor other expenditures. Thomas C. Kiefer, Montreal, 17 March, 1854.
In that turbulent election of 1854, Thomas C. Kiefer was not the only critic of John Egan. Here's an amusing little ditty composed by an Elmer Balladeer who wrote a campaign song for Egan's political opposition.
A good stick and a trusty hand, a merry heart and true, John Egan's men shall understand what Gatineau boys can do. And have they said the where and when, and will John Egan try? Then 1,500 Gatineau men will know the reason why. And will they buy the farmer bold, the flunkies they will try? Then 1,500 boys from Hull will know the reason why. Out spoke our leader, brave and bold, a gallant man is he. If Aylmer Town is Egan's hold, we'll make John Egan flee. All parties will go hand in hand, and there shall be no stray. go side by side from strand to stand, and who will bid us nay? And will they stuff 'em down our throats, and will the flunkies try? Then twice 500 erdly boys will know the reason why. And when we come unto the polls, a pleasant sight to view, come forth, you cursed fools, we're better men than you. John Egan, he keeps watch and ward, John Egan, he may try, but all the brave Lochinvar boys will know the reason why. Old Ruggles, he may skin his slaves, old Ruggles, he may try, but all the men of Temple 10 will know the reason why. John Egan, he will think it fine, John Egan, he may try, to leave in chains the brave O'Brien who fought for Libertry. But all the boys from Erin's sod will fight him till they die, and all the men of Buckingham shall know the reason why. John Egan, he may make canals, John Egan, he may try, but all the gallant nation lads will know the reason why. John Egan, he is rich and fat, John Egan, he may try, John Egan, he may fancy that he can the farmers buy, but our brave lads, though poor in purse, will make his flunkies fly, or twice 1,000 farmer boys will know the reason why. And will the nobles hunt us down, and will John Egan try? Then all the men that Ottawa has will know the reason why. Then lay down the county and the doe, hang up the broadaxe and the hoe. There's no more votes for poor old John. He's gone where all bad members go.
Given that anti-Egan balladeer and Kiefer's stinging rebuke of Egan in 1854, it came as no surprise to some that Egan ended his days as he did. After several years of stupendously bad business decisions, Egan's industrial wealth had been diminished by the time of his death to a net worth of less than 5,000 British pounds. A mighty fall for the Napoleon of Ottawa, who once had over $2 million pass through his account books annually during his heyday in the 1840s and early 1850s. Whether friend or foe, those who opposed or admired John Egan probably had their own good reasons for believing in him as they did. What in the final analysis can be said about John Egan? That much like the village of Eganville itself, John Egan was a man for all seasons. To judge from the nearly 200 years of newspaper archives gathered from all over the world, there are a few people quite like John Egan and few places quite like Eganville. Put another way, there's no place where news about John Egan or Eganville itself won't be in season. Even before it was called Eganville, the good people of this mighty little village and the Bonnechere River Valley were making a great noise in the world. Take this February 2nd, 1848 edition of the British Whig with its bold headline, "Good for Canada. The cesarean operation was successfully performed a short time ago on a married female residing up the Bonnechere in the township of Bromley by Dr. Alan Carswell of McNab." Or even, if a good doctor wasn't available in Eganville before 1852, the good folks of the Bonnechere still found a way to get her done, as can be seen in this story about Eganville in 1850s. It was a story retold in an Ottawa Citizen edition of June 23, 1928.
Eganville Cooper, of long ago, was very clever with the lancet. Another Eganville man was a clever bone setter, worked with confidence and good results. Recollections of the pre-doctor days. This is the story of how an amateur doctor at Eganville, of the bloodletting school, saved a young man's life in the 1850s by heroic bloodletting methods. The story is told by Mrs. Margaret Cameron of 162 Water Street. The thing happened in Eganville. There lived in the village at the time a good horseman who often rode horses in the steeplechase races, which were popular at that period everywhere in these parts. One day, while riding in a race, young Hennessy was thrown from his horse. The horse stumbled, and when he was picked, everybody said he was dead. It so happened that there lived in the village a cooper by the name of Armstrong, who, by the way, was the grandfather of Mr. A.J. Armstrong, the druggist of 66 Laurier Avenue East in Ottawa. Mr. Armstrong, the grandfather, it seems, was a most expert bloodletter. In most places, it was the village blacksmith who wielded the lancet in the absence of doctors. But in this case, it was the cooper, Armstrong, to whom the people always went when they had ailments for which bloodletting was supposed to be a panacea. Anyway, on the occasion of the accident to young Hennessy, Mr. Armstrong was sent for. He came, bringing with him a large basin and a lancet. There, on the stubble field, he cut a vein near the seat of the injury and drew from it a large quantity of blood. As the blood drained, the young man recovered consciousness and soon was in a position to be carried home, where, with careful nursing and a diet of rich milk and eggs, he recovered his strength. In later years, the young man joined the 100th Canadian Regiment and served abroad with distinction. Another excellent amateur of the 1850s in Eganville was James Kearney. He was a fine bone setter. On one occasion, Mrs. Cameron's mother met with an accident and dislocated one of her shoulder bones. In a most businesslike manner, Mr. Kearney, while a neighbor held the patient, put his foot against the dislocated shoulder and pulled the bones into their rightful place. Mrs. Cameron says a professional doctor could not have made a better job of it. Mr. Kearney was not only a good bone setter, all his work was without charge, but he, according to Mrs. Cameron, used to render all sorts of services to his neighbors in distress. He assisted in preparing the dead for their wakes, helped make coffins, and rendered other intimate services. "I feel sure he will receive his reward above," said Mrs. Cameron, "as he never got any while he was alive." At that period referred to, Mr. Kearney was only about 30 years of age.
Or take the international curiosity aroused about Eganville in 1853, when the Bonnechere Caves were first discovered at the Fourth Chute, or that more famous news story about the Great Upper Ottawa Valley Forest Fire of 1853.
Headline in the Perthshire Advertiser, published in Perth, Scotland, on June 23, 1853. Upper Canada, fearful conflagration. Ottawa County, Upper Canada, has been desolated by a conflagration which swept the county from Deep River to within a short distance of the Bonnechere River, destroying houses, fences, barns, cattle, provisions, grain, and every kind of property that came in its way. It is almost miraculous only two persons appear to have perished. The fire originated from the burning of new land in different parts of the country, and owing to the warm sunshine and high wind, the fire suddenly increased and spread with fearful rapidity. During the early part of the day, the wind blew from the southwest and carried the fire from the rear townships in Upper Canada northwards toward the settlements on the Ottawa River. At the same time, it was making alarming progress in Sheen and Chichester on the north or lower Canada side and the upper or westerly part of Alamed Island. Soon after, the wind suddenly went round to the west and blew with increasing violence. The fire, which till then was scattered over a considerable extent of country, through the townships of Pembroke, Stafford, and Westmeath, which lie in order as named, soon united and became a dense mass of flame and swept with fearful fury through the interior, passing over portions of Ross, Bromley, and Horton towards the Bonnechere River. During the greater part of the afternoon, the scene was truly terrific. Alamed Island, which is 14 miles long, was swept by fire from head to foot. The country burnt over extends in Upper Canada from the upper part of Pembroke and Stafford to near the Bonnechere River in Horton and Adamston, the distance being nearly 30 miles with an average width of some 12 miles. Towns which suffered were Pembroke, Stafford, Westmeath, Bromley, Ross, and Horton. The number of families who had been burned out of house and home amounted to 230, with the loss of property to some of them will exceed 1,000 pounds. The extent of the county over which the fire passed is about 450 square miles.
Nor did the world not take notice when tragedy struck in the Bonnechere in the late autumn of 1860.
Headline from the Kingston Whig Standard, October 27, 1860. 7 men drowned. The melancholy news has just reached us that 7 raftsmen of the firm Egan and MacDonald were lost on Tuesday last at Golden Lake on the Bonnechere River. They left Eganville, 8 in number, in the morning, and had paddled as far as Golden Lake with a barrel of biscuit, a chest of tea, and some provisions on board. When a gale struck up, and Barr, the only survivor, said, "We must go ashore." The foreman said, "If you want to go ashore, we'll put you." And they had not time to say another word, for a third wave filled the canoe with water, which immediately capsized. Barr swam for shore, but wearied, returned for his paddle, and by the time he got hold of it, two brothers had come up and seized the canoe, grasping each other with hands across the canoe. The canoe swung round to Barr, who managed to get on it and made for shore, using his paddle. When they approached an island, one of the brothers asked, "Are we near the shore?" Barr said, "Yes," but one of the brothers said he could hold on no longer, and dropping his hold, both went to the bottom. Barr reached the island and remained there all night. The whole scene was witnessed from the mainland by a family named Thomas, who could render no assistance. It is with melancholy pleasure in connection with this catastrophe that we learn that 4 of these 7 respectable young Scotsmen who were drowned attend a church on the Sabbath before they were suddenly called to another world.
Of course, there was increasingly less need to read about Eganville news in those far-flung newspapers from around the globe. By 1870, Eganville had its first telegraph office, a line built by the Montreal Telegraph Company. A second and third line would arrive soon afterwards with the coming of the Dominion and the Great Northwestern Telegraph offices. In fact, by the summer of 1878, around the same time as J. Lorne McDougall Jr.'s lumber business failed in Renfrew, and he was appointed as the first Auditor General of Canada, Eganville witnessed the rise of its first hometown newspaper. Dr. John Shannon House set up as the publisher and editor of not one, but two newspapers, the Eganville Enterprise and the Eganville Freeman. The Enterprise was a conservative weekly with an annual subscription of $1, and by the end of its first year, it had 832 subscribers. It is presumed that the Freeman was liberal and was at least competitive until it was not, and so went out of business. 10 years later, Dr. Shannon House sold the Enterprise to William Reeves, but the paper's editorial viewpoint seemed to shift to something more liberal than the founding publisher could tolerate. So in 1890, Dr. Shannon House launched his third newspaper, the Eganville Star, another proudly conservative weekly. Patrick McHugh, the son of one of the town's several blacksmiths and hotel owners, began his own newspaper career as a printer's devil at the Eganville Star. He would eventually take over as its editor, but Mr. McHugh, perhaps also chomping at the bit of his publisher's decisively conservative editorial policy, decided to launch his very own and much more liberal Eganville Leader in 1902. For over 40 years, the Eganville Enterprise would stay in business one way or another, including during some lean years when it published a combined Eganville Enterprise Star newspaper. After the rise and early success of McHugh's Eganville Leader, that other village newspaper again reinvented itself as the Eganville New Enterprise. Finally, in the spring of 1919, the New Enterprise folded for good, another casualty of the Great War. Not to be left behind by the village's rush towards technological progress, in 1881, Eganville also saw its first photographer set up shop as John A. Smith put out his shingle. Regardless of the rise of Eganville's own developing mass media technologies, the world at large still found certain aspects of Eganville beyond fascinating. Take this story, first published by the Montreal Star in 1884 and soon picked up by the newspaper throughout North America.
February 23rd, 1884, the Montreal Star headline. A strange wedding present, a gentleman served with an action of damages on his wedding tour. A few days ago, Mr. Simon Howard, a wealthy merchant of Eganville, County Renfrew, Ontario, arrived at the Albion Hotel in this city with his bride on their wedding tour. The next morning, the first call made upon the newly married man was by a bailiff who served him with the writ of a $10,000 action for damages taken by this quondam inamorata Miss Anne B. Howard of Montreal on the alleged ground of breach of promise of marriage. It can be easily imagined that this wedding present of a new kind was not quite agreeable to the bridegroom. The declaration of the plaintiff in this case is a lengthy one, and sets forth her various grievances against the defendant. It is alleged, amongst other things, that Simon Howard, who passed considerable time in Montreal during the year 1871, was very assiduous in his attentions to the plaintiff, and there and then promised to marry her. Having returned to Eganville, he kept up regular correspondence with the young lady, and not satisfied with the promises already made, he, moreover, bound himself in the name of Jesus and Mary to marry the plaintiff. This was agreed to, and the engagement entered into, as appears by several letters exchanged in 1872. In 1873, Howard came to Montreal for the purpose of marrying, and presented his fiancée with an engagement ring. The preparations, however, being rather lengthy, he went back to Eganville, promising to return in the spring of 1874. Since then, his business has suffered somewhat from depression, and he has always delayed marriage until in January of last year, 1883, the plaintiff heard that he was about to get married to another lady. Upon hearing the news, she caused her attorney, Mr. P.U. Renard, to write and inform him that if he deserted her in order to marry the lady in question, she would take an action against him. No reply was given to this letter, and the next thing heard about Howard was his marriage with an Ottawa lady, hence the present action. The declaration further alleges that on the account of the engagement, the plaintiff has refused several more advantageous offers, and the defendant being worth more than $50,000, the amount claimed $10,000, is within his means and will be but a poor compensation for the harm and injury done her. Mr. U.W. Renault is the attorney for the defendant.
Certainly, there were more serious issues at play in Eganville during these days, and none more crucial than the coming of the railroad. In most cases, a single railroad might be devoutly wished by any 19th century village the size of Eganville, but three separate railroads were all vying to lay track through Eganville during the last few decades of the 19th century.
Headline from the February 14th, 1887, Kingston Whig Standard Edition that reads, "The Which Is It Railway? A Difference of Opinion in Regard to It. It's an election canard. The people of South Renfrew are excited over the Which Is It Railway. At a recent meeting, a conservative told of a line which was to run from Renfrew to Eganville and northward, and which had already been contracted for. There was a surprise, and not only the people of Renfrew, but the people of Kingston began to inquire what railway it could be. The Kingston and Pembroke Railroad said they had made no contracts, neither did they know of any other company having a charter for the road. The Eganville Enterprise Reporter fixed the line as an extension of the Ontario and Pacific Company, while J.R. Booth of Ottawa announced that it was an extension of the Canada Atlantic Railroad. And the Renfrew Mercury hinted that it was the take-em-all-in-a-loop line, built around the riding, in front of every man's door, and to run until Ontario Premier Ferguson gets defeated on the 22nd of this month. There's lots of fun about the imaginary line.
By 1884, the Kingston and Pembroke line only made it as far as Renfrew, but by 1894, the Canadian Pacific and the J.R. Booth's Ottawa, Armprior, and Parry Sound Railroad both opened up separate but spanking new train stations in Eganville. The giddy arrival of freight cars and passenger coaches meant many things to the villagers of Eganville, but to Father P.J. Dowdle, Eganville's reputable Roman Catholic priest, it meant only one thing. His annual fundraising summer picnic would grow exponentially thanks to special excursion trains from Ottawa. In fact, 5,000 people, including prime ministers, former and current, and aspiring prime ministers, were all jammed into Father Dowdle's 1911 August picnic in Eganville. Quite a feat given that barely a month before, half the town had been burnt to the ground by another great fire. It was the most recent of the four great fires that Eganville had suffered and survived since Gregory Boulanger first sparked his flint at the Fifth Chute. All the news fit to print about Eganville during the latter half of the 19th century, however, often centered around more than just fires, ordinary run-of-the-mill mayhem. Just plain crazy and bizarre things always sounded somehow different when the story originated or got told in Eganville newsprint. Take these next five local stories ripped from the headlines of Eganville's two turn-of-the-century newspapers, the Eganville Enterprise and the Eganville Star.
Headline, December 26, 1893, the Eganville Star. A double catch. A young man named Tom French, hailing from Renfrew, an employee of Mr. John McGuire at Barry's Bay, went out on the bay in a small bark canoe, trolling for trout. After paddling for quite a while, he observed a large buck coming towards him. When near the canoe, it churned and made for the shore quickly, followed by Tom, who, when he came alongside of the beauty, saw that its horns were entangled in his trolling line, the result being that the canoe and its occupant were being pulled towards shore. A Mr. Joseph Prince then appeared on the scene in another canoe, when the two men, with the aid of their paddles, succeeded in dispatching the noble denizen of the forest. When the exciting battle was over, Tom noticed the end of his line, a 28-pound trout.
Headline in the May 30th, 1895 edition of the Ottawa Journal, Treed by Wolves. The Eganville Enterprise reports that it has received the following information from an authentic source, which shows that wolves are by no means scarce around Basin Depot on the Bonnechere. On Tuesday last, as Mr. John Carabine, employed on the McLaughlin Brothers log drive under Foreman Reynolds, was carrying a bag of potatoes from the depot to the camp, he was chased by a pack of wolves. Not wishing to abandon his load, and it being rather weighty to run with, He climbed a tree, taking along with him, however, the potatoes. The occurrence happened in the evening, and it was not until early morning that the denizens of the forest took their departure and permitted him to resume his journey. Mr. Carabine states that he would have tried to chase them off by throwing potatoes at them, but he was afraid he would have none left for breakfast.
Headline in the August 9, 1895 edition of the Ottawa Citizen. Big fire in Eganville. Business block destroyed. Last night at about 7:30 p.m., fire broke out in the McIntyre-Pulotsky planing mill and spread rapidly, taking the large block owned by John Bridge of Renfrew and occupied by J. Rennick as a bakery and confectionery, also the store and residence of John Casey. The buildings were totally destroyed and the stocks badly damaged by smoke and water. The loss is between $6,000 and $8,000 and is nearly covered by insurance. The origin of the fire is unknown at present.
Headlined in the October 18, 1895 edition of the Ottawa Journal, Treed by a Moose, an adventure which an OA and PS railwayman will not forget. The Eganville Enterprise says Mr. Neil King of Lake Dory was nearly killed by a bull moose last week. Mr. King is in the employ of the Ottawa Armprior and Parry Sound Railway Company on the exploring party near Source Lake, and, while engaged with a companion in portaging provisions, he sat down to rest. While sitting, they were suddenly attacked by a bull moose and had to flee for their lives. The companion succeeded in climbing a tree, but while Mr. King was in the act of climbing another, the moose reached him. One of its antlers entered the leg of his trousers and ripped them to the top, Mr. King being thrown to the ground. Another toss, and Mr. King was thrown 25 feet away. Bruised and hurt, he sprang to his feet and succeeded in getting into a tree, from whence he emptied his revolver into the moose, wounding it severely and driving it off. The two then made for the camp as rapidly as possible. The next day, Mr. King, securing a rifle, started in pursuit and found the moose not far from the place where it had attacked him. As soon as the moose saw him, it charged, but Mr. King's first shot brought him down.
Headline in the June 28, 1896 edition of the Kingston Whig Standard. Rural Dean Bliss will not let agitators rule in Eganville. The Eganville Star reports that those who attend divine service in St. John's Church on Sunday morning heard some pretty plain facts in connection with the past history of the church. The rector reminded them all of the ministers they had during the past 30 years, how they were treated, and how they left the parish in disgust, some remaining a little over a year. It got to be almost a proverb in the Diocese of Ontario that no minister could live in Eganville. There must be something wrong, and the rector explained in somewhat forceful language, the trouble rested with the great majority of people taking no interest in the vestry, the governing body of the church. It was left in the hands of the few who only attended the vestry meetings, and in consequence ruled the parish, making themselves disagreeable to the minister and obnoxious to many in the congregation. He said he would not submit to any party or faction, nor be dictated to by parochial agitators, parish cookers, wire pullers, underhand influences of a lay pope, and therefore he called on all fair-minded and honest people to do away with the agitators and assist him to conduct the parish in the way God ordained it to be. Let everyone be in love and charity with all men.
It simply never pays to underestimate the comings and goings of Eganville folk. Take this young fellow.
Headline in the September 21st, 1896 edition of the Ottawa Journal. Eganville, a Renfrew County cheese, wins a medal at Chicago. There is on exhibition at Pembroke the medal and diploma awarded to Mr. Alex McGregor of Mixburg for his excellent exhibit of cheese at the World's Fair at Chicago. Out of a possible 45 points, Mr. McGregor's cheese got 44.5, 29.5 out of 30 for texture and body, 15 out of 15 for color, and 10 out of 10 for finish. When it is considered that this was competition with the world, Renfrew County may well feel proud at having produced such a result as this.
Or this simple story that made the news wires as far south as Salt Lake City, Utah.
Headline in the July 14, 1897 edition of the Salt Lake Herald, published in Salt Lake City, Utah. Herman possibly arrested near Eganville, Canada. A great sensation was caused in Eganville by the arrest of Mr. Hamilton, a lay reader of the Church of England, congregation at Scotchbush, near here, on the charge that he was Reverend Francis Herman's, wanted in Salt Lake City for the murder of Henrietta Clausen. Herman's disappeared in May 1895, and in June, a J.B. Hamilton, writing from Boston, Mass., applied to the Bishop of Ottawa, Canada, for leave to work in his diocese, furnishing testimonials. He was sent as a lay reader to Scotchbush, but at the end of the year, the bishop refused to renew his license. He remained, visiting among the farmers, but his actions became peculiar, and he seemed anxious to avoid strangers. Some weeks ago, a lady from that section visiting at the residence of Dugald Campbell of Eganville and looking over the National Detective and Police Reviews saw the likeness of Hermans and said, "I have seen that man," and told where she had seen Hamilton. Campbell at once commenced inquiries, and after finding out all he could about Hamilton, went to see him and got into a conversation with him about his travels. Campbell was certain he had the right man and communicated with the authorities in Utah. The result was that on Saturday, Constable Mitchell, acting under the direction of Crown Attorney Metcalf, came to Eganville and, accompanied by Campbell, went to Scotchbush and made the arrest. Hamilton denied that he was the man and said he had never been in Salt Lake City. His statements, in that and other points, don't agree with statements made to others before his arrest. The prisoner was brought to Eganville. On his way to the jail in Pembroke, and as the constable was afraid of his captive, he was not only handcuffed, but had his legs tied. Campbell, the constable, and the Crown Attorney all believe they have the right man.
For this horrific triple murder-suicide out of Wilberforce Way.
Headline, in the November 3rd, 1899 edition of the Buffalo Times, published in Buffalo, New York, Dominion Dewings slew wife and little daughter, took two doses of Paris Green, and tried to blow off his head. Eganville, three black coffins lying side by side in the residence of William Yaster in Wilberforce Township, Eganville, tell the story of the most horrible combination of murder and self-destruction that has ever shocked the people of Renfrew County. Two of the black boxes contain the bodies of the murdered. The other encloses the remains of the murderer. The murderer himself came to judgment by his own act. Blood-soiled axe and cup of Paris Green were the instruments of destruction which blotted out three lives. William Yaster, who lived at Germanicus Post Office in Wilberforce, was the murderer's suicide, and his wife and 10-year-old daughter were the victims. The story of the crime is of a most exciting nature and reeks throughout with fiendishness and ghastly fury. Tuesday night, about 10 o'clock, Yaster secured an axe and approached the bedroom in which his wife and daughter, Louisa, were sleeping, and, without even giving them a chance to ask for mercy, cleft open their skulls. He hacked at their heads until he left them a mass of almost unrecognizable flesh and bone. The maniac next pulled the dead bodies out on the floor and got into the bed that they had occupied and slept soundly till morning. At daybreak, he awakened two younger children, told them he had murdered their sister and mother, and requested them to go out and inform the neighbors of the crime. After the children's departure, Yaster mixed up a dose of Paris Green and gulped down two draughts. The neighbors, on their arrival at the House of Blood, found the murdered women where they had lain all night and discovered Yaster in horrible agony. The dose of Paris Green, however, failed to work, and it was then that Yaster's fiendishness manifested itself to the utmost degree. He filled his mouth with gunpowder, torched it with a lighted match, and succeeded in distorting his features most frightfully. But again, his attempts at self-destruction were a failure. As a last resort, he took another dose of Paris Green, and his death finished up the last chapter in a dark tragedy. Before his death, he told the doctors that he had murdered his wife and daughter because they were always troubling him. For the last few years, Yaster had been regarded as insane, and it was while in a fit of madness, with his mind inflamed, that the awful deed was committed.
Lest you think Eganville news over the years has been overly morbid or even overly dramatic, there is one story tonight that we want to leave you with that we think best makes our point. It's a story about absolutely nothing happening, but only in Eganville does nothing seem like something really important happened, and so it was worth telling the world.
Headline from the August 28th, 1900, Eganville Star, unequal to his opportunities. There is a young man who lives in a neighboring town who needs a tonic of some kind, else he would not have failed to embrace as attractive an opportunity as ever comes to one. He accompanied a charming young woman to a church wedding and arrived at about the same time the bride and groom were due. The young woman with him was dressed somewhat as the bride was expected to be clad, and when she walked up the aisle of the church with her escort, the organist began to play the wedding march. The couple, however, instead of going onto the altar, stopped in one of the pews not far from the front. One of the ushers came forward and told them that the clergyman was waiting for them, and their friends near, perceiving a situation, urged them to respond to the summons. The young woman said she was ready and willing, but the young man, to his everlasting disgrace, refused to move. If he lives to his dying day, the people will know the girls say that he will not have another chance at such happiness.
So there you have it, a glimpse at Eganville's ancient history. Honestly, we only scratched the surface. I'm Kayla Desjardins, and for Gerald Priestley, Jack Rosine, Ben Searson, Blake Tubby, and our producer, Barry Conway, all of us here at Bonnechere Museum would like to thank you for taking an interest in your very own fascinating local history. Good night and safe travels.
The most curious local history of the Bonnechere River Valley back in the 19th century. We can hardly wait till they get to telling us all about the shenanigans and malarkey that happened there in the 20th century. I'm Kristen Marchand, and for the producer of the Opiongo Line, Barry Conway, we'd like to invite you here again, same podcast, same time, next week, when the Opiongo Line will bring you another very unique new show. It involves a 30-member, can't-keep-from-singing Polish Kashub choir that's making its debut performance in Wilno, atop Shrine Hill, at this very moment as we speak. We'll have it all for you in all its musical glory here next week, a show not to be missed. Good day, and God bless.